This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Carolyn Quinn. Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour for Sunday, November the 12th. MPs are preparing to start their line-by-line scrutiny of the EU withdrawal bill in the Commons, the latest in a line of crunch points for the government. And one of the first amendments up is from Frank Field, one of the Labour Party Brexiteers. He's on the panel, along with the Conservative Anna Soubry, who, to put it mildly, takes a different approach to Brexit to Frank Field. And the author and columnist Lionel Shriver will be here as well. Ian Blackford, the SNP's leader at Westminster, tells us how his party will be using its 35-member clout in the Commons to push for the softest possible Brexit and continued membership of the Single Market and Customs Union. And after another grim week for Theresa May, words of advice from people who've similarly found themselves in the eye of the political storm, including the former Minister Steve Norris, who breaks his vow never to talk about John Major and Back to Basics by talking to our reporter Mark Lobel about John Major and Back to Basics. And our expert guide to the week ahead here at Westminster is provided by the Deputy Political Editor of The Times, Sam Coates. Let me introduce my guests here in the studio. Anna Soubry, former Conservative Minister, who's known as one of the most outspoken and independent Conservative backbenchers. She's the MP for Broxtowe in Nottinghamshire and describes herself as a lifelong One Nation Tory. Welcome to you. And independent. And Frank Field is a similarly independent spirit, a former minister on the opposition benches now. He's been MP for Birkenhead for nearly 40 years and chairs the Work and Pensions Select Committee. He's one of the relatively small number of prominent Labour figures to back Brexit. So welcome to you. Well, both Anna and Frank have been with us before, but new to our table and bringing a cool-eyed writer's perspective to proceedings is the novelist Lionel Shriver, author of the award-winning We Need to Talk About Kevin and The Mandibles, among others. Her books have examined some of the most difficult themes of contemporary American life, including the motivations of a mass killer, the healthcare system and obesity. You're living in the UK now, writing a regular column in The Spectator. And recently, I read in that column, you wrote, however the opinion, freedom of expression has benefits, given the rope to hang themselves, fools, liars and demagogues make ample use of the noose. Here you are at Westminster. Were you directing that at anyone or any group in particular?
Well, for all I know, I was directing it at myself.
Well, feel free to say whatever you want. Freedom of expression is very, very welcome in this studio. Completing our lineup tonight, Sam Coates, Deputy Political Editor of The Times, who's always got something worthwhile to tell us about the week ahead. So we'll be tapping into your brains in just a moment. We're not all about Brexit tonight, although the on-off alliance between two of its key cabinet proponents does manage to weave its way onto our first story. As you heard in the news, Richard Ratcliffe, whose wife Nazanin is in jail in Iran, has spoken to the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson on the phone today. There's been widespread criticism of Mr. Johnson for telling a Commons committee last week that Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe was training journalists in Iran at the time of her arrest last year. Well, Jeremy Corbyn today called for the Foreign Secretary to be sacked, accusing him of repeatedly letting our country down. And the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, said Mr. Johnson's comments were the latest in a series of gaffes and offensive remarks for which he should go. But on the Andrew Marr programme, Michael Gove, the Environment Secretary, who a year ago knifed his colleague's leadership ambitions in the front, defended Boris Johnson to the hilt.
Yes, I think Boris is doing a great job as Foreign Secretary. I also think that the attempt to shift the blame away from Iran and onto a democratically
elected
tradition...
I'm not trying to shift the blame away
from
anybody.
No, I know you're not, Andrew, but I think that it's plain wrong for us to try to find fault with Democrats when the real responsibility is to say to the Iranian regime, you are a serial abuser of human rights. We play their game. We play into the extremists' hands if we do anything other than show solidarity in the face of their abuse of human rights.
Well, Frank Field, so many words have already been expended on the gaffes of Boris Johnson. The list grows daily, it seems. Do you think he'll still be in place by Christmas?
Well, can I first say I thought that statement by Michael Gove was equally horrendous. I mean, the idea, we all know how evil the Iran regime is, but the idea you may go around playing into their hands so that they both think, well, we have got the right person in the first place as a spy, and then might double her sentence, is truly horrendous behaviour. So I think both Michael and Boris should be ashamed of how they behaved in the last week, putting somebody at risk. We're going to come on to later about Brexit and what should follow, the budget and so on.
We will have
a few suggestions to make. But I do think it's totally unacceptable for Cabinet members. It would be unacceptable for me or Anna as Member of Parliament to be making these suggestions and putting people at risk.
Well, Anna Soubry...
Let alone Cabinet Ministers. It's atrocious behaviour.
All right, Anna Soubry, you've criticised Boris Johnson. You've called for him to go already, but...
I called for him to go weeks ago after
he's still there. Will he still be there at Christmas?
I don't know. I mean, frankly, at the moment, goodness knows what will happen in all manner of respects. I mean... He should have gone weeks ago after he undermined the Prime Minister's Florence speech, in my opinion, and then he wrote another article for The Sun, I think it doesn't really matter, but laying down what others interpreted as his red lies. But this, in itself...
It is
terrible.
And do you share Frank's criticism of Michael Gove as well?
I'm afraid I do, because... It's just bizarre to try and stand up for what Boris has done. You know, it's not a question that Boris has said something which could be wrongly interpreted. He was very clear in what he said, and he was wrong. Mm. This woman is wholly innocent. She's done nothing wrong. She's been falsely, wrongly imprisoned. The fault, of course, is with the Iranians. But the primary duty of all government is to protect its citizens and keep us safe, especially your foreign secretary. And if there's any suggestion, and there are many, that he has undermined the safety of a British citizen, that in any event is
out. And Michael is a seriously intelligent person.
Yes, he is.
All right.
He knew fully well what he was doing with his feet in first.
Yes. Solidarity should be with Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe. That's where the solidarity is.
Let me bring in Lionel here, because Mrs. Ratcliffe's family say that Boris Johnson shouldn't resign, that there's been too much instability already. Mr. Ratcliffe hopes to travel to Iran with the foreign secretary, and he said he doesn't believe that his wife's interests would be served by more instability. He said Mr. Johnson's got a crucial role in the weeks ahead to stand up for Nazanin. I mean, is it the argument that, you know, yes, this was a mistake by Boris Johnson? He has said that now he is convinced that she was not training journalists. He has said in the House of Commons that she was on holiday with her family. Is it time to take off the pressure from Boris Johnson, do you think?
Well, I think it's important in relation to the Nazanin case to acknowledge that the mistake is already made, whatever you think of it. And as far as the Iranians are concerned, he can't take it back. So if there was damage done, it is done. It would certainly be seemly of Boris to do whatever he can, including go to Iran if necessary, to ameliorate the situation. I'm a little skeptical how successful he's going to be. The Iranians are going to believe what they want.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do her any good by getting rid of our foreign minister. And I think that this is a very bad time to do that.
But he actually tell his mate to shut up, though, couldn't he?
And I have to say, I don't think you were there, Frank, but I was in the House when he made his statement. And he was, you know, jabbing his finger and shouting at the Labour benches at a time when he should have been saying, I got this wrong. Let me make it very clear.
Absolutely.
And I am very sorry. And that was what upset a lot of us, was the lack of contrition.
Sam Coates from The Times, what is the chance of Boris Johnson being moved, or is he unsackable? Is he unresignable?
Well, I think, first of all, let's have a little look in relation narrowly to this issue. I think that if it so happens that Boris Johnson's comments result in Nazanin's sentence being extended, I think that's pretty much case closed. I think it's very hard, if there are concrete consequences from his remarks to Parliament almost 2 weeks ago, then I think the clamour to get rid of him would be overwhelming, and you would I think Theresa May would be forced to because he had endangered and effectively hurt a British citizen overseas. But more broadly than that, I think the cabinet dynamic has gone back to him being a relatively important figure who it looks to me like she would struggle to sack, particularly now, whatever you think about it, like it or dislike it, he has teamed up with Michael Gove on Brexit. They are right now...
They were supposed to be there in the first place.
They were there, and, of course, and Michael Gove didn't make it straight back into government. But they are there now trying to set a path on Brexit to ensure that they get their model of Brexit, which in itself is quite contentious, and use their combined political effect power to lean on her.
Let's just explain what this is about. There was a report in the Mail on Sunday today that... Mr. Johnson, Mr. Gove have jointly written a memo, a confidential memo to Theresa May.
And then one of them
outlining their worries about the progress on
so
Brexit.
Confidential,
Mr. Gove.
It definitely came from one of them.
Yeah, how could it?
Well, we don't know. Hold on, everybody. We don't know how it got into the public domain.
But we have a good idea.
We don't know yet. I mean, Sam Coates, who's been on duty today and talking to a lot of people, may have an idea. But the crux of it is that here are two cabinet members reforming their bromance, if you like, working together to send instructions to Theresa May about Brexit.
Absolutely. On leaks, can I just say, never, ever jump to conclusions. You all think you all know.
Oh,
but having written stories based on leaks, I look agog at the wild speculation that it generates. And it's almost always wrong. You're right. This memo talks about how, it indicates how Boris and Michael are working together. Now, I put in quite a few calls today, particularly allies of both of them. And the basic idea that they're working together seems true. Now, just hang on for a moment. Why is that important? They are working together because, and I don't think anybody around the cabinet table or indeed in the party would deny this, because there is a vacuum coming from number 10 Downing Street when it comes to leadership, leadership generally, and leadership on Brexit. And I know cabinet minister after cabinet minister who has said directly to me or to people that I've spoken to that they just don't see any drumbeat coming from Theresa May as to where we're going. So you have two people trying to seize the agenda. Now, make no mistake, there are several people around the cabinet table who want to seize the agenda, take the debate in different ways, particularly on Brexit, Philip Hammond being a very good example. But I think Michael and Boris, who teamed up in Vote Leave, are a pretty formidable force, whether like that or not.
Anna Soubry, how dangerous is this bromance, if we're calling it that?
Well, that's your expression. Look, it does concern me, because it's as if everybody's forgotten that on June the 8th, we had a general election. And my party lost its majority. And that means that everything changed. And unfortunately, some people just don't accept that. And so to keep on banging on about a hard Brexit, the off the cliff, when the people have actually rejected that, and increasingly people are becoming very concerned about Brexit, they see that they have been conned and they are worried about what's going to happen. They don't want off the cliff. They want a deal. And I want them to see there's another alternative. And that is another option, which is to be like a Norway deal. You know,
we are going to get on to Brexit in just a moment. Let me ask Lionel, you're a writer, you're a novelist. What do you make of the human drama of all of this? You know, the characters and the personalities. As a novelist, these personalities must fascinate you in a way or not.
Well, certainly to have Michael Gove and Boris Johnson doing anything together at this point makes me imagine it. It must also be possible for the Miliband brothers to be going off on camping trips. But fair enough. On the one hand, as a novelist, I find all these machinations fascinating. But as a member of the public watching this spectacle, I get impatient.
Yeah.
As a member of the public who cares what happens and what this government is doing, I don't care about who's with whom and who's helping whom and, you know, who's backing May and who's being a little wishy-washy. It's clearly the image being presented to the public is one of mayhem and discord. And there's important business to be done. Yeah. Now, I would like to get back to what Anna said about the election in June, and I think that she misrepresented the results. I don't think you can say that the people rejected Brexit effectively by losing the conservative, not electing a conservative majority, because after all, both main parties were supporting
Brexit. They rejected the hard Brexit.
I don't think you can say that. I don't think you can draw that conclusion.
No. All right. Frank Field, can I just ask you just a brief question here? Is there is the fact that we've had this memo from Mr. Gove, Mr. Johnson, is this a sign of the language toughening on your side of the argument? You know, you've got the deadline for agreement drawing closer. Michel Barnier, the EU chief negotiator, saying the UK's got 2 weeks to clarify how much it will pay for the Brexit divorce bill. Are you, as a Brexiteer, sharing the concern of Mr. Gove and Mr. Johnson that there needs to be a different approach?
Well, I saw the Prime Minister the other week. I submitted a memoranda. Sam has never reported on it because I haven't leaked it. So this idea that the main writers of a memoranda about how the Prime Minister might be dealing with current affairs got into the public domain because people decided it should get in the public domain. So I don't accept this stuff about where the responsibility lays on this. I also agree that Anna's wrong in that there's this tendency for us to interpret the election result as we wish it to be. You could say that this was an immensely successful election for Mrs. T, biggest Tory vote ever. She won overwhelmingly in every social class, bar the poorest, DE.
Our majority.
But we were saved
by the Scots.
But Anna, what I'm saying is the puzzle is, given that we had somebody brilliant on our side after losing by 60 seats to say we've won, and for the Tories to believe they were lost.
I'd like to move, though, to look to the week ahead, and we will be talking now about your different approaches to Brexit. Let's talk about the big parliamentary drama coming up this week. The Gove-Johnson memo comes to light as MPs are preparing to start that line-by-line scrutiny of the EU withdrawal bill. Now, last Friday, Theresa May announced a government amendment to the legislation which says that Britain will leave the EU on the 29th of March 2019 at 11 p.m. The bill's got 62 pages, 19 clauses, hundreds of amendments. The SNP, with their 35 MPs, opposed the bill on second reading, and they're now planning how to use their parliamentary clout over the weeks ahead. Their Westminster leader, Ian Blackford, dropped into our studio a little earlier, and he outlined the SNP's concerns.
One, of course, is the power grab that's taking place from the Scottish Parliament, because there's 111 areas of devolved competency that in the short term are coming back to Westminster. So it's the disrespect which is shown towards the devolved administrations. Then, of course, there's the economic situation, because I would argue that nobody, when they voted last June, voted to become poorer. And there's a significant economic risk if we're out of the single market and the customs union without a viable alternative. And we're no closer to that viable alternative being put in place. We've got a government that seems to be at war with itself. We know about the letter that came from Gove and from Boris Johnson arguing for a stronger line in the Brexit talks. So there's some real concerns that we have as we go into the withdrawal bill that we're no clearer to understanding what kind of post-Brexit future we're talking about.
So there are a number of amendments that have been tabled to this bill. Are you working together with Conservatives, with Labour MPs now, to try to get the kind of changes to the bill that you want?
We will work with MPs across the chamber to make sure that we protect our own interests in Scotland, and if I may say so, the interests that we perceive of the rest of the United Kingdom as well. So yes, we will work with people. We do want to protect being in the single market and the customs union. And if others are prepared to come to that view, then of course we'd be delighted to work with them. I take the view that if we are going to be faced with a scenario that we're leaving the EU, that we're talking about a no-deal scenario, for example, it's beholden on all of us to work together to make sure that we can protect the interests of people in this country.
Well, you want Scotland to be able to stay within the single market and within the customs union, yeah, don't you? But, I mean, realistically, you're not going to be able to change this bill to make that happen UK-wide, are you?
I'm not so sure. I think if we are faced with a situation of a hard Brexit, I think a lot of MPs are going to be looking at themselves and looking at what impact that will have in their constituencies. And so I don't take it that we are automatically leaving the single market and the customs union as we see things today.
And what do you view as the key areas where the government could be vulnerable in the weeks ahead?
I think there are four areas, very briefly. One, of course, what I've talked about, the devolved settlement, the fact that they're taking back control from our administration in Edinburgh and the one in Cardiff and in Belfast. The fact that we're dealing about the economic threats that are there from not getting an effective trade deal. Thirdly, the Henry VIII powers. And fourthly, the attack on human rights. So I think there are four areas where we'll be seeking to work with others over the coming weeks. And of course, it's not just about this committee stage. It's about how that then rolls on to the House of Lords and comes back to the House of Commons. So this is something which is going to take some time. I'm aware of talks that are going on in the House of Lords, and I expect to see substantial opposition that will come in that place from peers on the Labour and the Liberal side, and indeed from crossbenchers. So I think the government will face a pretty stark battle when it goes from the Commons with the bill into the House of Lords.
That's Ian Blackford, the SNP leader at Westminster. Sam Coates, looking ahead now, this is a big week, isn't it? Just can you give us, in a few sentences, what this week is all about?
Well, this is a long-delayed moment where the EU Withdrawal Bill, which is the bill that takes European law, puts it into British law, hits the Commons, and some of the most difficult stages hit the Commons for the first time. Now, there's a morass of legislation, a morass of amendments, but I think one thing to pick up on will be Tuesday, when the Commons debate what was going to be the Frank Field Amendment, which called for a date to be named for the precise moment that we were to leave the European Union. Now, on one level, that's a symbolic and archaic piece of information that just hadn't been specified in the legislation. But some Brexiteers had feared that the lack of naming a date might allow the timetable to slip, or it to be done in some ways and not in others. So Theresa May last week announced that we were going to leave the European Union on March the 29th, 2019, at 11 p.m. That's midnight Brussels time. And that was the moment that we were actually going to leave. That will cause a rebellion on Anna's side of the Conservative Party, and there might be some pressure on that, but we wait to see. But that'll be the most difficult of the various votes on that.
So, Frank Field, yes, you had four clauses that you were adding to this bill, including asking for a date to be set for our withdrawal. Well, now that Theresa May has said there will be one, are you withdrawing your amendments, your clauses?
Well, I want to speak to them first, so I won't actually announce here what I'm actually going to do. But I thought initially there would have to be a date in the bill. I was surprised when I put down the amendments that there wasn't one. I don't believe the government will get this bill through the Lords. As you said, Caroline, there are 60 pages. Practically every word in every line could be amended, and their lordships will to destroy the bill. So I put down an alternative bill, which was, one, name the date. Secondly, transfer all the powers and regulations. Thirdly, the House of Commons should decide how they, not the government, will review this legislation, what to keep, what to amend, what to kick out, and that because as the date comes, power will spread, come to us because they need our money. There will be supplicants with empty bowls going up to Germany of EU countries saying, Mrs. Where's our money this year, because Britain isn't paying, that we should have a safe haven to complete the negotiations so that we do so in a position of power when they're wanting our money because there is growing discontent in Europe.
So a sort of set transition period you're talking about. It was a small
bill which the government won't accept in the Commons, even though it's taken Clause 1, but will, I'm sure, when they see they cannot get their bill through in the Lords, they will adopt this strategy. And when we need other powers that are in this extraordinarily long bill. It was only been thought up this length because they took a title of the Great Reform Bill. They thought, therefore, we must have many pages. We will actually come back and give days' debate and pass individual clauses, which will appear to us as bills.
All right. Well, that's the amendments that you've got down, and they will be discussed, you hope, yes, this week. Anna Soubry, I'm assuming that you would take a different approach to Frank Field on this. Are you prepared to vote against your own government when the arithmetic is so slim, when the majority is so small? Sam Coates suggests that you would.
Yes, I voted to.
Of course, we should, if we think so.
I voted to trigger Article 50 because I promised to honour the result of the referendum. I've done that. Even Ken Clark accepts that we are leaving the European Union. But from now on, I made it very clear to my constituents when I was elected in June that I'd continue to make the case for the single market, customs union, and so on. But on this, I am afraid I am not going again to vote against my conscience. And to that end, I think that the idea that we should put into law this date is a very foolish mistake by the government. It ties the government's hands. It actually weakens their negotiating position. It doesn't allow for, in the event of a deal not being completed, for any extension, as we know can happen. And, of course, the other thing, which I think it really is all about, is an aim, I have to say, to get no deal. And this seals no deal because it prevents what Dominic Grieve seeks to do with his Amendment 7, which is for an Act of Parliament on any agreement to come in and go through in the normal way of statute. So it's deeply concerning. It's also very peculiar that this amendment's been put forward by the government. We want to know, has it gone to Cabinet? Has it gone through the normal processes of a right round to make sure that other departments are happy with 11 o'clock on a set date? Will that be all right?
Anna, do you want us to leave? Are you one of these wolves in sheep's clothing?
You know,
I find this really quite
offensive, actually. Because I don't think you've ever voted against your conscience ever. And I did, because I promised to be true to...
True.
No, just this
no,
is
I
really
agree.
Important,
no,
actually. And, so, you know, some of you leavers, you would not have done that. You would have banged on if the result had been the other way around. So I promised to be true to the result and to honour and respect it. And I've done that. We are leaving the European Union. We now need to get the best deal, not for my generation, Frank, or yours.
And
need to get it right for our children and grandchildren. And these sorts of attacks, which then result in unpleasant attacks on me in social media, the death threats and everything else, are actually rather offensive. Let's get on. Let's try and bring our country together to get the best deal. Let's put the rhetoric,
Lionel,
the old divisions away now and move forward.
Lionel, as somebody watching this from the outside, but as somebody who voted Leave yourself, do you fear that there are some within Parliament who are attempting to scupper Brexit?
Oh, it's very obvious, from the outside anyway, that there is a movement that's gathering steam, a kind of fifth column, to overturn the result of the referendum. And
where's your evidence for that?
You just observe it, Anna.
I watch the news.
Yes, of course. Sorry, you
give me the evidence, because, you know, we all voted for the second reading.
I mean,
if you take a look at some of the books that are coming out right now.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Parliament. Where is your evidence that there is this fifth column in Parliament? So we're a democracy. People are entitled
but
to
Anna,
vote.
But
I'm talking about an impression. I think I'm here officially representing the public.
Yes, you are.
Absolutely.
And the public gets impressions. And the appearance is that there is a gathering movement to either simply keep Brexit from happening, to make people vote again until they get their minds right.
Yeah.
Or possibly simply to put together a Brexit which is so soft and keeps us in the customs union and the single market that it becomes tantamount to staying in.
All right, that's the view from the outside.
So
that is the view from the outside. That's the view of Lionel. I mean, Anna, you absolutely dispute that, but there are these different views going on.
Anna, I think you've had...
People are fed up.
Okay.
Well, I am.
Hold on. I think the British public actually is fed up. I think they do want us to get on with it. That's undoubtedly what I was hearing.
And Sam Coates, obviously there are these issues, there are so many things still to be untangled before an agreement can be reached on whether to move on to trade talks. That's the big crunch meeting next month. So, at the Brussels meeting.
So this week, undoubtedly, the EU withdrawal bill is the sort of the front row box office thing. But there are two very big debates going on behind the scenes in government. One is about the budget on November the 22nd, probably the most difficult budget of my lifetime, where there's no money and no political support to get through what's a very tough thing with lots of unpaid bills to meet. Those meetings are going on right now amid all lots of signs that there isn't going to be any great breakthrough on issues like housing, and there isn't any large amount of money to deal with universal credit and all that kind of thing. Then the other great big thing going on behind the scenes in government is you might think that the domestic end of Brexit is hard, but then the EU negotiation end of Brexit is also coming, ramping up at a rate of knots. Next month, in December, there's going to be a meeting with Theresa May and her fellow EU leaders, where they've got to decide whether or not we can start talking about what the kind of trade relationship is going to look like in the future. And there's a great big problem with that, which is we haven't worked it out. We haven't worked out yet in the cabinet the kind of relationship that we're going to ask for. And it's not clear to me that there are any substantive discussions going on at cabinet level yet as to what it'll look like, because you know that when the issue's about should we pay for the long term? How much should we align ourselves with the EU rules after we leave and after the transition period? What should the transition period even look like? Are subjects that are so immensely contentious, even around the cabinet table, that when it happens, there's going to be a big row.
There is another big issue, of course, the issue of harassment. The investigations continue, don't they? Theresa May has already lost a couple of cabinet ministers, not one of them, to this issue. Ian Blackford, who we heard from earlier, was among the party leaders who met Theresa May, the Prime Minister, last week. And he says that a working group is going to be set up to come up with a broad outline of a new grievance procedure for Parliament, which will be published by the start of next month. He said the new process has to be properly independent.
That has to be the case. We cannot be the judges in these particular cases. Staff members and others working in the Parliament have got to have that opportunity to come forward and make allegations if they have suffered from bad behaviour. And it would not be right for politicians to be judging that. And of course, if there has been bad behaviour by parliamentarians, there have to be effective sanctions. I think there's another aspect that we have to be very careful on as well, and that is training. I mean, I would argue that MPs need to be trained on how they should behave. Sad to say that that is the case, but that is where we are. And that needs then to happen on an annual basis. There has to be a refresher course. And, of course, I think it's important that staff get that access to training as well.
What have the tragic circumstances around Carl Sargeant, the former Welsh minister, who was sacked after allegations of impropriety against him and then committed suicide. What have those circumstances taught you and the other political leaders about how to handle these issues?
I suppose I am concerned to an extent that any accusations made against anyone at the moment, that you're now guilty as charged before you're given that opportunity to defend yourself. So it's important that we respect and we support those that are coming forward with allegations. But at the same time, what we don't want is a situation where someone is effectively then charged. I know it's a difficult balancing act, but it's something that I expect that the committee which is being established will have to look very carefully at.
So more training for MPs. What do you make of that, Frank Field?
I think the whole thing's balmy. In that, every serious organisation deals with this problem, knows how to deal with this problem, and we have a Prime Minister that if she would be confident on any issue, she should be confident about the issue of character and behaviour. And I can't see for the life of me why we don't look at a large company of our size outside that deals with this issue well and properly and effectively, and we just take that model and ensure that it's independent. The idea that it wasn't actually agreed at that meeting, that you need more meetings, fills me with horror.
Anna Soubry?
I think the Prime Minister's been absolutely clear about this. I mean, this is where she has absolutely shown the leadership, not only in the way that she took swift action when allegations were made against, unfortunately against Michael Fallon, but quite properly, she took action immediately. But also, it's her idea that we have this independent body, and it's absolutely the right thing to do. I think there's been more reluctance, if I may say, in the Labour Party, which I think wants to do more internally, and it's wrong. We need a proper system.
Absolutely, it needs to be outside our control.
Absolutely, we need to have an independent body.
Terrible,
we don't need to pay a lot of money and make it doubly bureaucratic. It certainly doesn't need to be like IPSA. Somebody can do it for us, just like any other big organisation or any other big business, and it would enable proper procedures to be put in place. The only time it gets difficult is when you then look at sanctions, because, of course, if you have a finding of gross misconduct, you can be fired in an organisation or a business like the BBC, whatever it may be, and that is more difficult for us. And so we need to find a way of perhaps looking at the sanctions at the same time we have an independent body that gives everybody what they should have, which is exactly the same rights at work as anybody else in any other workplace.
But I think the sanctions should include them for these the commissioner to be able to expel and for our constituents then to make a judgment.
All right, well, harassment obviously is one of the issues that Theresa May's been dealing with. People have said that she's been having her worst period for any prime minister in recent memory. She's had to deal with a second cabinet resignation, her misspeaking foreign secretary, more allegations of misconduct, and all this while preparing for the next round of Brexit negotiations. Now, our reporter Mark Lobel has been talking to some experts on all of this, veterans of crises past who've been in the eye of the storm or toughened it out in the Downing Street bunker. They share their memories and their survival tips.
Not that long ago, I was working for Ed Miliband, and now I am doing stand-up comedy. So it's like all our lives have gone slightly tits up, to be honest.
Comedian Aisha Hazarika knows a crisis well. The former Labour aide had a ringside seat during Gordon Brown's tumultuous years in Number 10. She thinks Theresa May has suffered from the lack of a full leadership contest before she became Prime Minister.
She was really untested as a political leader because she didn't even have to fight her own leadership contest. She actually ended up going up against Andrea Leadsom, which is like winning Wimbledon against a wheelie bin.
Nonetheless, it's often forgotten that Theresa May had a very strong start as Prime Minister. So did Gordon Brown. One of his closest aides was Spencer Livermore.
Gordon had only just become Prime Minister in 2007 when he was hit with, I think, the floods, the foot and mouth crisis, terrorism, and to be honest, shortly after that, the collapse of Northern Rock as well. And he did cope with all of those crises remarkably well, particularly for a kind of a new incoming Prime Minister. And it was that success that ultimately led to the speculation around the early election.
Oh, yes, that difficult decision about whether to call a snap election. Not one to mess up.
It definitely changed Gordon's fortunes, I suppose, in the opposite way to Theresa May. So by not calling it, it stole his momentum. And for her, calling it and it being disastrous stole her momentum. And then everything that then transpired afterwards, not possibly Gordon's fault, but suddenly was seen as a sign of poor governance inside Downing Street.
Amid all this, Gordon Brown faced a challenge of historic proportions. But Spencer Livermore says, with challenges come opportunities.
Gordon was able to so successfully manage the global financial crisis. Theresa May's external issue is Brexit. She needs to start governing in the national interest. She needs to start being brave.
Difficult, with no majority and a divided party. So, are there lessons from John Major's time in government? Charles Lewington was his press secretary.
It was really difficult for him to reboot his strategic narrative because every time he tried to, there was a defection or, you know, there was some other issue, be it sleaze or be it over Europe. The difference between then and now is that Major actually had quite a professional team around him. Theresa May's team is virtually all new. Parts of Whitehall don't feel there's a penalty if they don't tell Number 10 exactly what's going on. And I do feel that in the case of Priti Patel, if Number 10 was perceived to have got a grip across the system, someone would have tipped off Number 10 and the trip to Israel would have been stopped in its tracks.
BBC News at 8 o'clock. The Defence Secretary, Sir Michael Fallon, has resigned, apparently over allegations of past behaviour.
Over the past few weeks, Westminster has been rocked by allegations of sexual misconduct. Now a corporate troubleshooter, Steve Norris was a minister under John Major, whose private life hit the headlines. He thinks the current Westminster abuse allegations provide Theresa May with a precious opportunity. to deliver meaningful change.
I mean, the irony about John Major's Back to Basics is that it was actually about reforming education, getting back to the three R's, to reading, writing, arithmetic, and it was interpreted by a frankly overzealous staffer in Number 10 as somehow being about return to Victorian standards. And, yeah, you know, a few people, including myself, were caught up in all that. There's a real difference, I think, between all of that sort of fluff on the old News of the World sort of territory and what's happening now, because I think what's happening now is something profound and actually good, because we're looking much more closely as a society at what's frankly the abuse of power.
But for Theresa May, problems are piling up on many different fronts. Here's someone who knows how that feels, another ex-Downing Street insider, David Cameron's former communications director, Sir Craig Oliver.
Well, some extraordinary moments where you feel really under siege. And I remember when Andrew Mitchell was accused of calling a police officer at the gates of Downing Street a pleb. We had 30 days of unrelenting coverage. I remember Andrew Cooper, who was our pollster, coming in and saying, look, I've just done a whole load of focus groups and nobody can really register it. So the febrile nature of things in the bubble is often not reflected in the country. The problem is when it goes on over a period of time, it really, really buttresses itself and builds, and it's a bit like having a slow puncture.
And here's what Sir Craig says Conservative MPs would like to see.
We need the smack of firm government. We need somebody who's going to be authoritative here.
So, time to seize back the agenda and make some bold announcements. Who better to turn to than Robin Gordon-Farley, a former civil servant who until earlier this year was in charge of the Downing Street grid, coordinating all the key government announcements.
What she needs to do now, really, is to use some of the people that she really trusts in order to really clarify what that vision is. Because right now, I can't tell you what that vision is from based on what I've seen so far.
So what would he like to see?
At some point, you've got to really start setting out more detail about, you know, where the country's going on Brexit, what the future is going to be. I mean, right now, what I would be doing is concentrating on, we're 2 weeks away from a budget. You'll still have some bits of good news.
But with little spare cash available, an ambitious budget could bring dangers. Sir Craig Oliver again.
The expectation among MPs is incredibly high that the budget will actually deliver something that will change the political weather. One thing I think is increasingly clear in politics is something radical seems to need to be done about housing. It's also a huge problem because young people are turning against the Conservative Party in droves.
Another key constituency Theresa May needs to stop deserting the party, according to Ayesha Hazarika, is the business community.
I think a lot of senior figures in the business community who naturally would be more conservative feel more aligned to Labour right now because of Brexit. They feel that they're not getting a lot of empathy from Theresa May on Brexit.
Tonight at 5, the fate of Priti Patel hangs in the balance.
Theresa May has been forced to make two important cabinet changes in a week. So should she seize the moment and fundamentally reshape her top team? Steve Norris.
The only real answer is quite a fundamental reshuffle, which will not only clean the stable, to quote Ruth Davidson, but will, of course, also give her, hopefully, the opportunity to present the new team.
Ayesha Hazarika agrees.
I would actually have a bit more respect for Theresa May if she sacked Boris Johnson.
But hold on a tick, says Sir Craig Oliver.
On balance, I think that the idea that there has to be a mammoth reshuffle is slightly naive. It won't take too many people balanced on one side to really cause problems for this government.
Let's end on a note of agreement. All of our experts say this has been a premiership of two halves, and yet they say Theresa May will probably stay on the pitch. I'll leave the last word to Spencer Livermore.
The reason that she might survive is the same reason she got the job in the first place, that simply there was no one else. And that may well be the thing that saves her.
Lionel Shriver, your advice maybe for Theresa May. Do you have any sympathy for her? I mean, the reports today that 40 Tories would like to trigger a no-confidence vote in her. She's beleaguered, it seems, and besieged from all sides.
Oh, of course I have some sympathy for anybody who's down. And I think we all do, but that's the last thing that any politician wants. pity, at least.
Well, she's got chances to make big, bold moves, as people are calling for example, in the budget. Frank Field, do you think that that could be a moment for Theresa May to assert her authority? What would you like to see in the budget?
I think there should be one huge surprise, and therefore it shouldn't be this, or it won't be this. I think we desperate need of housing. I think we should link that programme of expansion of housing to using the apprenticeship levy to train people. We can now get apprenticeships, specific apprenticeships, done in 13 weeks. And when people have got the skills and have proven those skills on site, that then feeds into our immigration controls. We don't want to do that before. So it would be a huge packet. It would lift spirits, and it would lead her then, I think, after the budget, because she didn't have a leadership contest. The first guy who's commented said that. But to then say, I'm shuffling the government, I'm having a Brexit cabinet that's going to be in a full-time session like a war cabinet, others are going to be demoted to the second cabinet, and take it or leave it.
Anna Soubry.
I think that will assert her authority.
Anna Soubry, what do you think, for the budget,
I think Hammond's got a really difficult job to do because, as Sam said earlier, you know, it doesn't have the revenues that he would like to have, but, hey, it looks like he might actually in some ways be in a better position. I mean, obviously, I would like to see more tax cuts for the least well-off in our society. I think that's been a very good way of lifting people out of those low earnings. I would like to see more money for social care. I still think we haven't done quite. We need to get to a better place on that.
And universal credit, do you think something will be said on that?
I would very much like to see the period reduced to 4 weeks. I think that's absolutely critical. And I would also like to see a very small amount of money given over to our Citizens Advice Bureau. So they were the the best place people. I met mine only on Thursday to help people get through new claimants coming onto universal credit, make a huge improvement to
and
the
that
system.
Is something
and they
that's,
don't need very much money. It's
and
tiny.
That's going to be discussed this week as well, isn't it, Frank?
That comes up. When George Osborne was defeated over his tax credit cuts, it was because the Select Committee party members of all parties actually put a debate to the Commons and we voted. Government lost its majority. On Thursday, we have a similar debate on universal credit, which I think Anna is supporting, along with Heidi Allen and so on. We've got a majority in the Commons, and I think we'll see the government beginning to climb down on that one. But this will be a good U-turn, because it will actually help people who are being kicked into destitution.
Sam Coates with the front pages now, and there are doubts over May's ability to deliver Brexit, it says on The Independent. But any mentions of Damian Green and the ongoing questions about his ability to survive? What's happening with the investigation into him that's been carried out by Sue Gray in the Cabinet Office?
We're on day 8 of the investigation into the second most important person in government, which is an odd state of affairs, to say the least. Because we're on day 8, it hasn't made the front pages of any of tonight's papers. But Damian Green is being investigated, as far as we know, for two things. For criticism of inappropriate advances to a young activist, which he denies, and for suggestions that there was pornography on a computer seized 9 years ago from his office. He also denies anything to do with that. Whether or not it will result in him losing his job or not, I don't know, but what I do know is to have a cloud hanging over somebody so pivotal to Theresa May's operation is yet another destabilising factor for government.
All right, in a minute, then, give us a run through the main headlines that you can see on the front pages.
Well, there's a little bit of good news on the front page of the Sun newspaper, pointing out that the husband of the British Iranian backs Boris Johnson to stay in his job. But apart from that, it's a fairly dismal set of papers for Theresa May tomorrow. You've got The Guardian going on Brexiteers send PM Orwellian set of demands. That's reflecting the memo that we talked about earlier from Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. New doubts over May's ability to deliver Brexit. They pick up on the reports in the Sunday Times of 40 MPs willing to sign a vote of no confidence. I couldn't find any of these 40 today,
Coordinating
it.
You're not one of them.
Have you
spoken to anyone?
No, absolutely not.
They never declare themselves.
So personally, this story didn't make the Times because we couldn't find any evidence at all.
Oh,
and then we in The Times write about how Michael Gove creates new, has created more uncertainty for the British Iranian woman by his comments today. Oh. But the story I think everybody will read tomorrow when they buy The Times, I would obviously say that, traffic lights on motorways to cut congestion. This is an amazing story. There are going to be, according to Graham Payton, our transport correspondent, traffic lights on motorways on the busiest routes, and the system will be introduced next month during rush hours on link roads where motorways meet. So there you go. Government can change things.
Well, there we are. I wonder how we're going to pay for that then. What do you think?
Well, the introduction on free-flowing traffic in Birkenhead of traffic lights has meant an unbelievable hold-up.
We could have an urgent question
one will expect.
Tomorrow.
Yes,
we could have an urgent question tomorrow, actually, on where we're going next after the talks on getting that independent body in to look at grievances and complaints and harassment and so on and so forth. So Jess Phillips could well do that, and I would back that if she did.
And Lionel, in 10 seconds, what would you like to see in the budget?
I'll tell you what I don't want to see. It has been mooted that the VAT threshold for signing up may go from 85 to 26 grand, and that would be very unpopular with small businesses.
You do not want to see that. We'll look out for that.
Even if it's proposed, Lana, it will not be carried.
All right.
Absolutely. Don't you worry.
Well, that's all we have time for this evening. Thanks to my guests, Sam Coates, Anna Soubry, Frank Field, Lionel Shriver. Join us again same time next Sunday.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.